Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Greetings. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, and joining us from Washington, D.C., Libby Casey of APRN. Paul, the United States Senate election isn't over yet. Joe Miller is in court. He'll be in Juneau. Give us the update on what's happened while we were away and what we can expect here in the next couple of days, especially Wednesday.
This is the first election, I think, in Alaska history that's never going to be over. Joe Miller has serious questions about how the election was administered by the Division of Elections. He filed a lawsuit in federal court. The federal judge said, look, there are issues here that need to be resolved. It'd be better if they were resolved in state court. He refiled his lawsuit in Fairbanks, Superior Court. The state came in and said, look, we'd like to have this in Juneau. It's too much trouble for us to move our people and records back and forth.
That was And there were security questions.
Exactly. And so it wound up in Juneau. Senator Lisa Murkowski petitioned to intervene in the lawsuit because her interests obviously are at stake here. And that's where we stand now. There's hearings scheduled for next week, next Wednesday, I think it is.
Right.
And the case will get underway.
Steve, do we have any timeline about how and how long it will take for this to play out?
I know that this is on an expedited schedule. There are pressures at work here. For instance, if Senator Lisa Murkowski is declared the winner of this race, they want to know this quickly. They want the decision done made quickly by the judge. She has to get back, otherwise she could lose her place in the rankings of seniority in the U.S. Senate, and that could harm the state of Alaska. She could also miss some key votes that may be coming up in January or perhaps even later this month, although there is a break that's coming up. But they're also concerned about that Alaska would be disenfranchised in some way by not having a full representation in the U.S. Senate when the debates on some of these issues start. So, yeah, there are some deadlines that some folks who are interested parties, primarily the Murkowski administration or the Murkowski group, they want to see this decided by. And the speculation is down in Juneau that the judge will indeed work as quickly as possible. Don't be surprised to see an issue, a ruling issued on Thursday. We'll have the hearing on Wednesday, and then it's possible that the judge could make a ruling on Thursday.
Okay, let's get Libby Casey in here. Libby, let's get the view from Washington, and specifically, what are people there? We assume that Lisa Murkowski's been embraced by the Republican caucus, but what are they saying about her seniority?
I laugh, Michael, when you say that we assume she's been embraced by the Republican caucus, because, of course, remember what a cold, chilly reception she got when she announced she was running as a write-in. They really shut her out. But, of course, now that she's back, everyone's old friends, things have been smoothed over. The question people are asking, though, is when will this process wrap up, what you've just been talking about? And if it wraps up quickly, as Steve mentioned, then everything will be copacetic and we'll move ahead. But there is some question and a little bit of jockeying going on as to what would happen with her positions. This past week, Joe Miller made comments to Matt Felling on KTVA and said he's not concerned about holding up Murkowski's potential seniority or jeopardizing that with this court challenge. And he said, I mean, really, remember this whole earmark thing? We're trying to get rid of earmarks anyway. That's really winding down. And that's one of the big things her seniority provides. So he didn't seem to have concerns. But it's not just her in earmarking that her seniority helps Alaska with. She's the top Republican on the Energy Committee. She looks to possibly be the top Republican on the Interior Appropriations Committee, both plum seats for Alaska getting its leg in the door when it comes to policy. And so people are just asking when this will work out. There is one other senator who seems potentially interested in the Energy Committee top Republican spot, but all that jockeying will really happen in January. And so she's got about a month to get this worked out. The new senators get seated January 3rd. You know, Norm Coleman, who of course had that 8-month-long battle with Al Franken over the Senate seat in Minnesota, made comments to C-SPAN last week that he thinks it's time for Joe Miller to essentially give it up and move on. So everybody is kind of weighing in one way. There's not really a model out there for how long the Republican caucus might let the seniority issue sort of be on the back burner for her. Mitch McConnell did let Norm Coleman sort of tentatively keep his slots if he were to win 2 years ago. He ended up losing. But we don't know how long they'd sort of let her keep her spot with the assumption that she's winning. So we're just going to have to wait and see how this plays out.
I just wanted to note that in the Al Franken Norm Coleman election in Minnesota, it was July 7th of 2009 that Al Franken was sworn in, and Minnesota had only one senator from the period of January through July 7th. The state was able to function the delegation, but of course they have a much bigger House delegation. And it was just accepted that during that period of time they were going to have one senator. Steve.
Yeah, there's one other element that I feel that needs to be considered here, and that's Joe Miller's future. He's proved himself to be a viable candidate, and he may have a future in Alaska politics here if he decides that he wants to continue and possibly run for a statewide office or maybe even a state legislative office in the future. And at some point in time, he risks turning off voters and perhaps tarnishing all that he's created here since the Senate campaign got underway. I think he's got to watch how far he pushes this thing, because he risks turning off voters. There's a possibility of harming the state if this is delayed too long and he does wind up.
What about the argument, Steve, that this is his one big chance at the brass ring and he's never going to get another one
That's a perfect legit, and that's what he does. He has every right to do what he's doing. He has every right to do that, and that should not be denied to him. This is just something I think that he has to consider, though, what the possible ramifications
prudence, perhaps,
are.
Perhaps being the better part of valor.
Perhaps, and again, I certainly think Joe Miller has every right, obviously, to pursue this thing, to make sure in his mind and his followers' minds and his campaign's mind that this was done properly and it was done correct. And I just think that he has that right to go and do that. I do believe that there's a possibility here that he could turn off some of the electorate by pushing this too far. Perhaps I'm wrong. I think it's just something that he's...
Or turn it into a Saturday Night Live gag. Joe Miller has now gone to court in Mongolia.
Certainly that's what happened.
Okay, let's get Libby back in here. Libby Casey joining us from Washington, D.C. The Senate took a vote on earmarks and on the banning of earmarks. The ban failed by 56 to 39. Both of our senators, Democratic and Republican, were opposed to the earmark ban. Tell us, what did they say, and how was their arguments greeted by their colleagues?
Now, you're right, of course, this did fail, but it was a stronger showing by anti-earmark folks. 10 more senators voted to ban earmarks than they did earlier this year on a similar vote. 8 Republicans, including Lisa Murkowski, said, don't ban, we're not ready to go there. But 7 Democrats crossed the aisle and voted with those who want to get rid of earmarks. And so there's a little bit of creep on this issue, and it does show how that Tea Party message has resonated, the message that Joe Miller has brought forth, that earmarks are a marker of the past. And so it is interesting to sort of see how this will play out, especially as we go over the next round of budgeting. Now, Senator Murkowski's take on this is that she felt like she was actually with a pretty solid group. To be among 8 Republicans who said, I don't want to ban earmarks, despite the fact that their conference voted on a self-imposed earmark ban just a couple of weeks ago, and 8 of them are still standing up and saying, nope, we're not buying it. So she said this is proof that she's not a lone voice on this issue. And the message she's giving right now is that communities in Alaska will really have to step up to make earmark proposals work. And they'll have to do things like get matching funds, perhaps get them from the state, offer them up from their own community, and pass resolutions from the community saying, this infrastructure project is so important to us that we're making it our top priority. Now, Senator Begich continues to tout reform and says it's not earmarks that are broken, it's the process. And so he wants to see things put in place like what his office does, not just disclosing the request his office makes earmarks, but disclosing everyone who comes and asks for earmarks. And so he says that'll cut down on this image Americans may have of lobbyists skulking around the Capitol with their hands open. He says put it all out there, make it more transparent. And he agrees with Murkowski. Can get communities to really step up and prioritize. Now, it's going to be, as I mentioned, interesting to see how it does play out and how much this will be a political punching bag. But when it comes time to actually ask for earmarks and take earmarks, which senators will line up? Senator Begich says, all right, we've now had quite a few senators voting against earmarks. Let's cut them out of the process. Let's scrub their earmark request from the budget. We'll save a lot of money that way, and those of us who think this is right, we can get that money.
Paul, I wanted to ask you, thank you, Libby. This was a very unusual vote because you had Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, who was defeated in this election, but has been a formidable player, especially as a liberal, probably perhaps the most liberal member of Congress, voting the same way as Jim DeMint, perhaps one of the most conservative South Carolinians. They were both against earmarks, and the earmark ban failed. And I'm just wondering if a lot of the public is just sees this as, you know, the Congress of the United States is just incapable of change.
Well, it's an easy issue. To me, it's overblown. I hate it when I agree with Mark Begich, but he's dead right on this issue.
You don't have to, you know. It's not
no, he's right on this issue. Earmarks need transparency. They need oversight. They need accountability. That's all they need. It's too easy to take 1%, less than 1% of the federal budget and say, we're going to cut that and we're going to save the country. No, you're not. That 1% is going to get spent by the administration rather than Congress. I think the public's not really up to speed on what earmarks are. I think in Alaska's case, where we still have third world conditions across many areas of this state, cutting earmarks is ludicrous. It's cruel is what it is. And it's too easy for a congressman to say, look what I've done.
Yeah.
And they haven't done anything.
It's such an easy target,
it's
too.
It's so
you
easy.
Know, it's, I mean, when you
well, it
look
can't be
at,
that easy because they couldn't get even 40 votes
but,
for it.
But it's an easy target for people to take shots at this thing. And this is why it's, I think, come under so much fire is because it gets a lot of, I mean, look how much static Senator Stevens got. You know, you want money for what? Studying the Aurora? You know what? Or a museum in South Dakota, or a rainforest study in the middle
that was
of
in
Nebraska.
Iowa.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. So I mean, this has been an easy target for anybody who is an opponent.
John McCain, for example.
Right, and that's blurred the reality of what these
but
things really are.
Yeah.
It has. It's made it easy to go, oh, we don't want a rainforest and wherever in Nebraska. We're studying them or whatever. You know, some of it sounds ludicrous until you really get into what. Perhaps they really do have some legitimacy, but you don't get that far. They're just punchlines, you know, for comedians and
well,
for
as
pundits.
Speaking of comedians, as a great man said, now for something completely different. Steve, the Parnell administration surprised me and perhaps a number of Alaskans when they came forward and said,
yeah.
It's time to build the Susitna / Wautana Dam.
Yeah,
like tell us about that.
Blast from the past.
Yes.
Like, you know, you just kind of, I remember that. This is a dam that a project that if they build it, it would be about 15 miles above Devil's Canyon. If you've ever seen Devil's Canyon, and I've seen Devil's Canyon up very close, too close for comfort, as a matter of fact, it's a beautiful part of the Talkeetna River, but this dam would be up above it, and it would be a huge project, about $4.5 billion, I think, in 2009 or 2008 dollars.
And speaking of huge, if I might, the size, I believe it's 40 miles by 2 miles in some places.
Yeah, but it's not as big as the proposal that was made to build a hydro project.
Excuse
on the
me,
Susitna.
The lake created by the dam.
The lake created. That's right.
Yeah.
And that would again be up above the Devil's Canyon. While this sounds big, and it is, but it's not nearly as large as the original Susitna Dam project that was pitched in the 80s. And the state feels that it should, you know, some of the supporters of this, the state feels it should go in halfies on this $4.5 billion project. It would take a lot of the strain off of the Cook Inlet natural gas fields that supply so much of our energy needs now, but are dwindling at this particular point in time. This is also, the Wautana is also being touted as having a less environmental impact on the ecology than another hydro project that is being built or that is being proposed on the west side of Cook Inlet. That would have, according to the folks involved in this, have a greater impact on salmon, grayling, other fish. This, because of Devil's Canyon and the turbulent water that goes through that canyon, there aren't a lot of fish up above the canyon where this dam would be built, if indeed they do it.
Okay. Paul, what is the legislature apt to say about, first of all, appropriating a very large sum of money? I don't know that they'd have to appropriate $4.5 billion or $5 billion all at once, but it is ultimately a very large amount of money. And second, I'm sort of wondering, there are going to be legislators from Southeast and parts of Bush, Alaska, and people who are not associated with the rail belt, who might very well be asking, well, what do we get out of it?
What's in it for us? That's exactly what the problem is going to be. The legislature under this proposal would have to come up with $2.5 billion, I suppose. The rest would come up, would be brought up by rail belt utilities. That's still a lot of money. And you're going to have to. You're going to have to take care of Southeast Alaska and rural Alaska. They're going to want their cut. They're going to want an equal amount. It's going to be an incredible project. You're going to get flack from environmentalists, from fisheries people, from anybody and everybody, just what happened during the last debate on this is sitting a project. We're going to spend $300 or $400 million, and we may or may not go anywhere again. But it's time we talked about it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Paul. Libby, let's go back to you in Washington. Congress continues to meet in a lame duck session, and what we've heard for the last week is a lot more squabbling over virtually anything. Are there some opportunities here where deals might be cut by the senators who and representatives who you see on a daily basis, or is this what we have until Christmas when they finally go home?
Yeah, let's talk about the potential for compromise and working together. Right now, there's a bipartisan group working on negotiating these tax cut extensions. These are the taxes that were cut under George W. Bush. The question is right now, extend them all, extend only those for the middle class, or those also for people who make over $200,000, families that make over $250,000. So there is this group trying to hash something out. Also, the President's Deficit Commission unveiled their work this week, and they are trying to figure out how to tackle the debt. Now, they were not able today to pass their proposals on to the full Congress because they couldn't get enough votes for it to get out of their commission, but the majority of members did vote for it. And so it is really the first sign here in Washington that people are, that the very slow ball, the giant stone monolithic ball is starting to roll on figuring out how to deal with the debt crisis. But when we talk about politics being divisive and the lame duck session getting really heated, it is happening right now. And this week, Republicans in the Senate all signed a letter, including Lisa Murkowski, telling leadership in the Senate that they will not consider anything else on the agenda right now until the budget is worked on, that's budget crisis is figured out, and also tax cuts votes are done, that middle class, higher income tax cuts.
So in that context, what is apt to be the fate of the revision or the elimination of the don't ask, don't tell policy towards gays in the military?
Well, that's just it. Nothing can go anywhere unless some Republicans get on board. So don't ask, don't tell is held up. The DREAM Act is held up. There's a food safety bill that passed this week that there some tweaks need to be made. It turns out that may now be held up. But, you know, one thing I wanted to mention to you, the Senate is in tomorrow to talk about taxes. This week, the House just yesterday did pass at the Democrats' leadership this extension of the middle class tax cuts. And this was a real political thing. Don Young voted against it. And he says it's not because I don't want to extend tax cuts for the middle class. It's because I want the tax cuts to continue for everyone, even the wealthier Americans. And so it's political maneuvering here. When the Senate comes in tomorrow, they'll vote on two things, whether or not to continue the middle class tax cuts. Republicans are going to be against it, including Lisa Murkowski, because they say all or nothing. But they're also going to vote on another opportunity here, whether or not to extend cuts for everyone except for those making more than $1 million. Now, Senator Begich really likes that last one because he's worried about small businesses who maybe make over $200,000 getting crunched here. But he says, hey, $1 million, if you're pulling in that much money, you're not exactly a real small business. And yeah, you could probably handle the taxes to bump back up. Republicans say no way, though. So this is probably going to be dead in the water tomorrow, but they're coming in on a Saturday, not that usual.
Well, it sounds to me that the politics of this seem pretty straightforward, that we're going to put the Republicans in the position of voting for millionaires. Isn't that what this is about?
Absolutely.
Okay. You mentioned Don Young earlier. This might be a good place to bring in the fact that he was one of the few Republicans, one of only two, I believe, Peter King of New York was the other, who voted against the censure of Charlie Rangel, the Harlem congressman of long service and reputation. What can you tell us about that?
That's right. Representative Rangel had 11 ethics violations, and so he faced censure by the full House yesterday. And as you mentioned, Don Young, one of only two Republicans and about 77 Democrats, to vote against that. Don Young says, it's not up to me to judge him, it's up to the voters. And the voters in New York actually sent Charles Rangel back. He's going to be back here again in the new Congress starting in January. Young was one of only three Republicans to vote instead for a lesser punishment. And it's interesting because the three who did that were Peter King of New York, Don Young, and also Ron Paul. So he's sort of part of this rogue group. It was a surprise move, though, and did get some attention down here.
Okay, and Peter King of New York is somebody who's known Charles Rangel a long time, and they've worked on many projects, and they're senior congressmen.
That's right, so there was context there. That's right, and some members of the Ways and Means Committee who've worked with Charles Rangel for a long time, he was the longtime head of that, also had a hard time voting for this censure move. I mean, the guy's 80 years old. He was talking about his Korean War injury, and, you know, he has this strong reputation, but that reputation has been highly diminished over the last couple of years because of these ethics charges. But Don Young said, look, it's not really my business. It's up to the voters.
Okay. Thank you very much, Libby. Paul, the Obama administration, with the support, I might add, of many Republicans, says it's time for a pay freeze for federal workers. What would that mean here in Alaska?
Well, I'm not sure. It wouldn't affect the military, and there's a whole host of federal workers that are exempt from this pay freeze. I think at some point you don't advance in pay grade, but there's certainly no prohibition on increasing your pay through time and grade kind of advancement. People have looked at it, say this thing appears to them to be more symbolic than anything, and to me, when you read it, that's what it looks like to me. It's going to be a lot of talk about not much.
And can they get the votes to do it? I guess that would be the question. The Republicans, I heard, seemed to be enthusiastic for this and thought it was about time.
Well, I think the average guy in public, it sounds great, as long as you're not a federal worker. I mean, oh yeah, stick it to them. I think they can get the votes for that.
Okay. Steve McDonald, we have something a little bit different here. Kyle Johansen and Sherrese Millett, two members of the legislature, left the Republican Majority Caucus because they were unsatisfied with committee assignments. Mr. Johansen, Representative Johansen in particular, took a lot of grief from his constituents. Now they say they want back into the majority. Can you explain this to us?
No, I can't explain it at all. I have no idea what's being thought of here. Well, here's what we know. These guys, Millett and Johansen, they say they're good friends. Representative Millett didn't.
Some people in the media and the public are interpreting that to mean more than
more good so, more than that. Yeah. So, well, we'll take them at their word and they're good friends. But that obviously, this friendship is what motivated their leaving the caucus, the majority caucus in the House. Sherrese Millett was upset that she didn't get a key committee assignment, and to support her, Kyle Johansen said, "I'm out too." And then he really faced quite a storm in Ketchikan. The newspaper down there said he should be recalled. He's not doing enough for his constituents. He had an opportunity to have a very high-ranking position in the majority caucus, and he wasn't thinking of his constituents when he left the caucus. Instead, he was thinking about a relationship with a Anchorage representative instead. So the paper down there called for his removal from office. He went back, had a couple of town hall meetings that were evidently somewhat heated, and he got quite the earful from constituents. So now he's come back and said, okay, I want back in. So now it doesn't appear that the leadership is in any great hurry to decide whether or not he should come back or not. And he's waiting for word on whether or not he'll be accepted. He probably isn't going to get the gig he was offered in the first go-around by any stretch.
And this is a good illustration of how, when if you're a legislator and you get involved, however they want to characterize it, with another member of the legislature, you can get yourself into some real trouble.
Well, you're a public servant and you serve your constituency, and that's your job. And he had an opportunity here. Those are the facts. He had an opportunity to be in a very influential position to possibly, well, certainly he was sitting in a powerful position, powerful enough to influence some legislation that could help his constituents
and
his community.
Paul, anything you want to add here very briefly?
Well, I think I'll be surprised if his constituents don't do something. I mean, many of them truly believe that he put himself and his own political aspirations above them, above that entire region. So I think we're a long way from hearing the end of this.
Okay. Libby, let's go back to you in Washington here in about the minute and a half that we have. Environmentalists are gathering in Washington, D.C. for a big event for them. the 50th anniversary of the creation of the Arctic National Wildlife Range originally, which later under President Carter became the much larger refuge. Tell us about the celebration.
Yeah, there was an event last night honoring the Carters, President Carter and his wife, and all their work that they've done for this. And there is a momentum that environmentalists are trying to really push the refuge right now and use the anniversary as a moment to call for further protections. They want President Obama to declare monument status for the refuge that would beef up its protections and without having to get congressional approval. A lot of environmentalists, I think, are in mourning a little bit that as the House goes over to Republican control in January, windows for pushing things like getting the refuge more protection are closing. There's no way that can pass in the Republican-controlled House. You know, I remember when President Obama won the election and I went to some environmentalist press conferences 2 years ago, and they were like, we have the president, we have the House, we have the Senate, Democratic control, we can get a lot done. That era is closing up as Republicans come back in. So it's sort of like Groundhog Day. You go to these Arctic Refuge events and you've heard it before and it's the same players, but they're saying, let's try to find a new way to get energy, to get more protections.
And right here, Groundhog Day is over. Have a good week, and we'll see you right here next week on Anchorage Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.